You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Happy Monday. I'm Bill Radke. How much right does the public have to pull back the curtain and see behind-the-scenes communications of their state lawmakers? Well, Washington State has had a Public Records Act since 1972. News organizations love it. It's how we find out the stuff that sometimes people would rather we didn't see. But lawmakers say there needs to be some limits to what information is public, that they need some degree of privacy to do their jobs. And on Friday afternoon, with broad bipartisan support, they voted to remove themselves from the Public Records Act. And with us now to explain, we have Associated Press State Capitol correspondent Rachel LaCourte. Hiya, Rachel.
Hey, Bill.
Will you explain briefly for newcomers the Public Records Act? What is that? How do media use that?
Well, so as you stated, it was a voter-approved initiative that passed in 1972. It had not just to do with public records, but also campaign finance disclosure. It was a broad sort of open government sort of initiative, and has widely been understood to apply to all elected officials, local, statewide, and employees at state agencies. Within the past several years, though, the legislature has claimed that it's exempt from the State Public Records Act. And they've said it, they would deny requests that we would make for things like calendars or emails, things like that. And we would say, no, we're pretty sure you're subject to the law. And they'd say, no, we're not. And we kind of went back and forth like that for a couple of years until last year, a coalition of news organizations decided to get a final judicial ruling on that and see, well, are they? I had done a lot of research looking into the history of language that they cited that they said made them exempt, and it just didn't ring true to me. And so this coalition of news organizations filed suit in September, arguing that they are subject to the Public Records Act. A month ago, on January 19th, the Superior Court judge agreed that all state lawmakers are fully subject to the act. And then you saw what happened this week. A bill was quickly introduced on Wednesday. There was no official public hearing or committee vote. There was just an informal work session that was organized less than 24 hours after the bill was introduced. And then one of the quickest votes I've ever seen in the legislature by both chambers.
Yeah, so we'll talk about the quick vote in a moment. I want to say that the Associated Press and Public Radio are party to this lawsuit over how the Public Records Act applies to lawmakers. And we did reach out this morning to some lawmakers who support this change that we'll talk about. And we couldn't work out the schedule with any of them to come on the radio during today's episode of The Record. So let's talk first about the argument. You said the judge ruled against the legislature, but sometimes judges' decisions get overruled and the legislature is appealing this. Why do they say that they ought to be exempt from the Public Records Act?
Well, and again, to be clear, the bill they passed on Friday exempts them from the State Public Records Act, but creates kind of this new carve-out for legislative disclosure obligations. It's a much more limited sort of disclosure law where they say they would release starting on July 1st. So the law would be retroactive. That means any records that would have been due to the media groups that the judge ruled in favor of are exempt and will not be released. But starting July 1st, things like information from their daily calendars, correspondence with people outside of the legislature who are not constituents, and any sort of final disciplinary report. So there are records that they will release that they previously did not release, according to a judge, illegally. That will start on July 1st. But you're right. This case is currently under appeal. They've appealed for direct review to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court hasn't said whether they'll take it directly or kick it back down to a lower court. And so lawmakers argued that the emergency was that a stay hasn't yet been issued in this case. They inaccurately say that the Superior Court judge refused to issue a stay. That's not true. Their lawyers didn't ask for a stay from that court, but they have asked for a stay from the Supreme Court, and that's still pending. There were recent filings in that that sort of direct review case just this week. So we're still waiting to see what the Supreme Court has to say. But of course, you know, with this bill passing, it's unclear. I mean, I think we know what the next step for the legislature is that they're going to ask that the case get tossed out completely.
So you said the legislature is willing to release all these records retroactive to July 1st and
no,
forward.
No, not retroactive. No, the law is retroactive. So that means they will not release any documents from before July 1st of this year.
So is that the
July 1st?
So is from July 1st forward. So is the only argument about records from July 1st into the past?
No, that's a major concern as well, but there, the limitations on the proposal that passed, there are several things that open government advocates have great concern about. One of them is the lack of judicial review, which even at the work session, one of the lawmakers on the committee kind of asked a staff member, like, are we even legally allowed to do that? And no one seemed to know the answer. So under the current State Public Records Act, if you feel you have been denied a record unjustly, your recourse is through the courts. They take that option away under this measure. The final sort of arbiters will be the Senate Facilities and Operations Committee and the House Rules Committee. And so the main problem with that is that they're the ones who reject your request, and then they're the ones who deny whether you were denied unjustly. And Senate F&O Committee, at least they kind of send out their schedule in a public way, and the media is allowed to go to that. The House Rules Committee sends out no such public disclosure, and we've even asked before in previous years, like, hey, can you guys let us know when your Rules Committee is meeting? And we've been told that it's mostly done by telephone. So there is some concern about transparency for the final sort of deciders on whether something has been denied unjustly. And also just sort of the limitation on the final disciplinary record. A lot of what sparked our concern about records we weren't getting from the legislature has to do with concerns about sexual harassment and misconduct, which has been in the news quite a bit this past year. And we know for a fact that some of these things are kind of handled behind the scenes, and there's no official report that's ever issued. So a lot of times when we learn about issues like that at the legislature, they're often leaked to us, and it's not that there's any sort of official report. Will that change now that they've kind of created this new sort of carve-out? I guess we have to trust that we'll do that, that they'll do that, but they haven't done it previously. So there are a lot of concerns about just sort of kind of black hole areas of information under the law that passed.
Well, there are areas that some legislators say they might need to keep more private than you would like, than news media would like. In fact, the Senator Sharon Nelson from Maury Island said that responding to all of the media's public disclosure requests would make legislating more difficult. It would make it so lawmakers can't function. How does being exempt from public disclosure help lawmakers do their jobs?
Well, and that's an argument that we've heard a lot, and there have been a lot of local, you know, county, city elected officials who have been like, hey, we've been able to do it. There is a concern about, you know, a burden that is put on because of some of the, you know, high volume of public records requests. And people have said, you know, there's a conversation to be had about that. And even at that work session, one of the publishers who came down on Thursday was like, let's slow this down and talk about it and have like a full conversation about how to make it so that state government doesn't grind to a halt because you're responding to public records requests. Another issue that they raise is this whole idea of, you know, constituent privacy. And you know, I can guarantee that, you know, the media here, we're not wanting to read every single constituent's, like, personal sort of story if they're going to a lawmaker to kind of talk about something that's very sensitive. There's already exemptions within state law under the State Public Records Act when it relates to invasion of privacy. And basically, already an exemption exists that if something would be highly offensive to a reasonable person, it is not of legitimate concern to the public, that information can be made exempt. So they already have a vehicle to exempt some of the most sensitive constituent email from disclosure. And if they felt that it needed to be tightened up a bit, you know, the lobbyists for the newspapers noted that you can make specific exemptions for the existing Public Records Act to address some of those concerns, as opposed to exempting wholesale the legislature out of that and creating some new carve-out for them.
Now this goes to Governor Inslee. What does the governor say about lawmakers exempting themselves from a voter-approved open government law?
Well, and the governor has long said that he thinks the legislature can be as transparent as he is. Now, it's important to note that the state Supreme Court did rule a few years ago that the governor's office has what's called an executive privilege. They did put some sideboards around it, so it was never a blanket exemption like the legislature has long claimed. It's basically like, as long as there is a policy discussion that's ongoing, that information can't be released. But after the fact, it can be. So, for example, contract negotiations with state workers, we can't get that information while it's in process, but we can get it afterward. But that said, the governor, since he took office, hasn't claimed executive privilege to not release other information, and he has said that he thinks the legislature can act as he have acted. That said, he hasn't said what he's going to do one way or another. Lawmakers, in posts that they've been putting on social media and emails they're sending to constituents, are saying kind of as fact, oh, the governor's not going to sign it and it will just take effect this week. I've asked the governor's office whether he is just going to do that. Just if the governor doesn't take any action, the law automatically takes effect. If he vetoes it, it has to go back to the legislature. They passed the measure with what's called veto-proof margins, 41-7 in the Senate, 83-14 in the House. They just need two-thirds of the legislature to override a veto. They far surpassed that in both chambers. But advocates, the open government advocates who are asking the governor to veto it, have said, well, make these lawmakers think about whether they want to take that vote again, because a good deal of them are probably hearing from their constituents at this point. We still don't know what the governor is going to do. He's currently in D.C. For the National Governors Association meeting, and I believe he's back tomorrow. I think there's some lack of clarity on whether it's Thursday or Friday on when he has until, but it is later this week. He has to take some kind of action or else the bill becomes law immediately.
And then is that the end of the story, or do you think there might be a voter initiative around this?
Well, I mean, we've heard some chatter about that on Twitter and elsewhere, but as you know, an initiative, it's a bit of a high burden for the public to get that to the ballot. The Media Coalition's lawsuit is still in process, and so there, the attorney for that coalition has said the retroactivity of the bill in order to basically erase a negative court ruling against said, entity is going to be challenged by the group. So there's not much that can be done about the July 1st going forward element of the lawsuit or of the law, but the retroactivity that says, that court ruling never happened because we have retroactively said we were never subject to the Public Records Act, that is something that the attorney has said will be challenged.
We've been talking about this with Associated Press State Capitol correspondent Rachel LaCourte. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we reached out to some of the lawmakers who voted yes on this bill regarding the Public Records Act, and they were not able to appear on the record today. So we'll try again. You've been listening to KUOW Seattle. We'll be back with more of The Record in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Amazon's second headquarters will be in Austin, Texas, if you believe the peacock theory cooked up by Texas Monthly Magazine. Okay, so 3 weeks ago, Amazon ran a Super Bowl ad in which Alexa loses her voice.
In Austin, it's 60 degrees with a...
Did you hear what she was saying when she lost her voice? The weather forecast in Austin, Texas. And Austin happens to be on Amazon's list of finalists for its second headquarters. So that was hint number one. Then in the same Super Bowl ad, a man asks his Amazon device this.
Alexa, play some country music.
Play some country music. Okay, there's country music in Austin, Texas. So those were the obvious hints. But I didn't catch the third hint in that Super Bowl ad. It shows the actor Anthony Hopkins feeding a bird.
I'm afraid Brandon is a little tied up.
But do let me know if there's anything I can help you with.
Anthony Hopkins is feeding a peacock. And guess where a lot of peacocks live?
They just always have lived here. And everybody knows that who lives here.
They're like an Austin institution.
In fact, there are so many peacocks there that the city of Austin put up school crosswalk signs in neighborhoods where there are no schools.
Children crossing sign, and I guess that's because the city doesn't have a peacock crossing sign.
Yeah, well, here's another sign Austin might need soon. Amazon crossing. Effects on city may be larger than they appear. It's The Record. We'll be right back. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening to The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Millennials are selfish and entitled, says Time magazine. The New York Post says millennials need to put away the juice boxes and grow up. My next guest says that cliche misses the bigger point, that when it comes to the important stuff, millennials have been more neglected than coddled. Author and filmmaker Sean Scott has written the new book, Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
May I offer you a juice box?
I've got some tea here.
You do? Okay.
So I think I'm going to be good.
You're good.
Unless you guys have high C or Capri Sun, then I might have to take
Sunny D. First of all, Sean, in your own house, you had three generations. You had boomer parents, you had Gen X siblings, and you. How did your parents treat you differently from your Gen X elders, if at all?
I think it's kind of a thing where a lot of baby boomers sort of felt like maybe they had been a little bit too permissive with Generation X.
Mm-hmm.
The schools had gotten too lax. Maybe Generation X was just sort of written off both societally as sort of a lost generation. And I think there's also sort of a sense in a familial way that you get a second chance with millennials. You get the chance to return, to go back to basics.
I should say the Gen X is my generation, arguably. Right. I'm sort of near the boomer cusp,
right.
but I remember we were the latchkey kids.
Right, And we were too. I mean, that's something that I think millennials and Generation X have in common. I think the difference is that the latchkey entertainment started to become a lot more martial, I want to say, in the way that you had this whole sort of culture of fear that I remember pretty vividly with like Dare, Dare to Keep Kids Off Drugs and McGruff the Crime Dog.
Oh, yes.
All these sort of just ways that it became clear that there was kind of like a culture of overprotection that surrounded a lot of millennials. And I remember that a lot too. Like back to basics is a phrase that I almost feel like I get like PTSD when I hear those words because I think about, sort of having to drill down and do doing long division was like a test of character. It wasn't just, can you solve this math problem? It's like, can you win the obstacle course? And I think that's kind of the reality that's facing a lot of millennials still. In one way or another, we're still sort of hopping through certain hurdles and not necessarily knowing why they have to be there in the first place.
Well, your parents were going to pay more attention to you than to the Beavis and Butthead generation that I was in, right? Was that the idea?
Right, yeah. And I mean, Beavis and Butthead was great because I remember watching that show a lot. And my parents, who were Jamaican immigrants, mostly just kind of thinking it was nonsense. And so if you're gonna look at that, we're not even gonna take you seriously right now. But most parents didn't really have that attitude, right? I tell the story in the fifth chapter of my book about how there was a kid, I think it was in Florida, who like burned down his trailer because Beavis is always saying fire, fire. And so at one point in time, this kid gets the inspiration to burn down his house literally, and it actually literally forces MTV to take down the 7 p.m. airing of Beavis and Butthead because they figured out that's when the most unattended kids were watching the show. So they pushed it an hour later. And that's just kind of one of many examples that I try to highlight in my book about how rather than actually sort of giving families and people the resources that they needed to spend more time at home, rather than pursuing paternal and maternal leave, rather than having universal health care, rather than having all these social programs that would make it so that people could spend more time with their kids and not worry about lapsing into poverty or sliding even deeper into it. In the 90s, we sort of had this culture war spectacle where we were paying more attention to Beavis than we were to, the social safety net.
And is that because, America was never that broadly socially progressive, or was there some other reason why parents seemed to focus more on the, I don't know, the symptoms, the low-hanging fruit, than actual systemic change?
Right. Yeah, and I think it's definitely the case that we sort of culturally have taken a turn. I think at a certain point in time, we made a million different cultural transactions that just put us more in a place where if somebody is struggling or they need help, we're looking at that more as a mark of personal deficiency than as a collective problem. The most unequal, I don't want to say the equal period in American life, but the most unequal, or the most equal period in American life, excuse me, was that period that ran from, say, post-World War II until the middle 1970s, where we sort of said questions like poverty, like civil rights, like access to healthcare, those are collective decisions that we need to have a functioning legislative framework to address. That gradually sort of got chipped away, I think, as we made the transition into the 1980s, and that's where you start to see much more sort of a sense of if you're having an issue with it, it must be something that's wrong with you. And that's how I think a lot of young people who have never really known, a lot of millennials in particular, who have never really known anything but that cultural climate, tend to look at and think about social problems. But I also think as we've aged, we've made a transition out of that. Like you look at the one of the reasons why so many millennials were excited by Barack's campaigns, by Bernie Sanders's campaigns, is it's sort of the sense that we can actually do something to muster collective will to address social problems.
Would you say that America needs a 1960s style, kind of like a reckoning with income inequality of the kind where we grapple with systemic racism?
Right. I mean, there are people who are in the Ku Klux Klan who will get defensive when you call them a racist and say, I'm not a racist. There are like skinheads that have swastikas tattooed onto their bodies who say, I'm not a racist, right? So we had, at one point in time, we had a collective referendum on race relations in this country to such an extent that people that are on such an obvious side of the racial divide don't want to be called out for intensifying that divide in such a way that we've never had a similar conversation like that en masse, I feel, about class and structural inequality. So that I want to live in a world where you know, Jeff Bezos says, I'm not a capitalist, as he's on his way to the bank, right? Like, I want to live in a world where somebody like Warren Buffett, even if they're going to sit there and hoard a bunch of money, at least culturally, we need to get to the stage where we recognize wealth inequality as a problem, as opposed to, you know, most Americans thinking of themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires, right? And if only they get the breaks that enable them to make it into that millionaire class, that's when maybe they'll start being able to recognize class is more of an issue. I think that's kind of the stage that we're at now, where we need to have that kind of a frank conversation about wealth inequality being a big problem.
Yeah. So when it comes to race, white Americans made two different definitions of racism. So there was still the systemic racism, but the kind of attitudinal,
right,
you know, well, but I'm a nice person,
right,
got separated.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what would that look like with income inequality? We'll still have it, but it won't. But people will wring their hands over it?
Right, right. Or you sort of get to a stage now where, I mean, maybe the corner has turned a little bit, not enough, but I think there is a general sense of self-awareness that people who maintain a lot of privilege have in, you know, maybe spending a lot of money on clothes that make them look poorer than they actually are, mm-hmm. or having a house that's, you know, maybe 10,000 square feet smaller than it would have been if they were just going all in like people did in the 1980s with, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous. But I think that the great thing about having a frank conversation about class and about structural inequality is that you figure out pretty quickly who the posers are versus who the protagonists are in that sort of narrative and trying to get to a more equal place societally.
Well, Seattle has been one of those places where it's not cool to flaunt wealth.
Right.
But has that made Seattle any less unequal as it's turned out?
It really hasn't. I mean, and I'm sure there are a lot of housing activists that would be surprised to hear that it's not cool to flaunt wealth, because at every, you know, city hearing that you go to where we're trying to advocate for more affordable housing, it's very, very clear who the folks who have you know, proto mansions and neighborhoods that are not too far from here, maybe in Wallingford, maybe out in Magnolia or elsewhere, who are actually pretty unapologetic about wanting to hold on to and maintain what I think is a pretty clear vestige of class and race disprivilege in the form of a lot of single family homes. And so it's Seattle is kind of one of those places where the branding is very, very strong. And I think those of us who have maybe been on certain sides of activist battles here know the reality from the representation.
Well, then what would you say to a baby boomer or a Gen Xer who's out of work in some Rust Belt town who says, I wish I were a millennial. I wish I were a digital native who has a better shot at the jobs of the future.
Right. And that's where I say that ultimately what I try to do in my book and in a lot of conversations that we have about millennials is really use generational politics as a proxy for talking about a lot of these larger questions, and that there are as many millennials who are part of the 3 to 5% of millennials locally that Zillow identified in a 2015 study as being as having a median income above $300,000. As there are many millennials that fit into that mold, as there are many baby boomers that are struggling seniors that might be vulnerable homeowners who maybe got bamboozled in the during the Great Recession with a predatory loan. Many baby boomers who might not be naturalized citizens, as it turns out. And so these conversations about disprivilege, I think I use generational politics as kind of a poison pill to have a lot of these larger kinds of conversations. And hopefully when people read the book or when they listen to the show, they don't think that I'm out here trying to say that, you know, all millennials have a halo on their heads. And if you're a baby boomer, the best that you can do is just kind of fork over the debit card.
That book, by the way, is Millennials and the Moments That Made Us, and it's written by author and filmmaker Sean Scott. And did I understand it right, Sean, that you've argued that it would help if we approached social problems the way we do sports?
Did I say that?
Or did I mangle that?
No. I'm gonna try to own it.
Okay.
I think, you know, I'm a huge Seahawks fan. I was a fan of the Sonics when we had a team. I've disowned the Mariners, but that's a separate conversation. And I noticed, like, sort of the passion that fans take to sort of more peripheral cultural concerns like sports or maybe like reality TV, and just the massive investment in time and energy that it takes to be an up-to-date fan. And you think, you know, I sometimes grow reflective. It's like, man, you know, could you take this down by even 25%? I think I'd probably be a lot more knowledgeable about local politics. Or even about national politics. And so it's kind of a constant reminder that a lot of the cultural pursuits that I talk about in my book, I try to link those as quickly as possible to politics so that we're not sort of lost in the maze of symbols and signs, and we're working our way back over to substance.
Mm. So we need a state legislative fantasy draft.
I think so. Well, there's going to be a lot of them. I was listening to the public records request segment that you did. I think there's a lot of a lot of House Democrats that a lot of people did a lot of work for that probably couldn't get drafted by a lot of people who are pretty mad at what they went and did, making life harder on journalists and radio show hosts like you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I laughed when I saw this idea of that a sports approach was helpful, because I think of sports as being the, you could call it harmless tribalism, but the ultimate kind of partisanship and tribalism, win, lose,
right.
You know, I hate 49er fans or right. Whatever. I thought, really? Sean wants more of a sports attitude in public life than there already is?
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, I think we should nationalize the Seahawks. Is that such a big deal? I think there's a pretty frank conversation that we need to be having about sort of sports as people using that as sort of like a substitute for a federal commitment to maybe providing more jobs or other kinds of federal commitments or even municipal commitments that we could be making with collective will. We tend to think that, you know, sports will provide the jobs, sports will come on in and spur business at local restaurants and shops and things like that. And that those are really a function of kind of declining civic identity that people used to have in an earlier sort of era, now sort of redirected into avenues that can actually end up hurting cities in pretty calculable ways.
You know. Sean Scott's book is Millennials and the Moments That Made Us, and you dropped something earlier that you said that you're the child of Jamaican immigrants.
Right.
What is the generation conversation, millennials, Gen X, baby boomers, what's the Jamaican version of that? Have your parents ever talked to you about that?
Well, like a lot of sort of post-colonial subjects, it's interesting because my parents never really knew, in Jamaica anyway, and a lot of people who you could talk to who are maybe from Venezuela or who are from India, those were countries that actually for a decade or so had a pretty in-depth socialist experiment. And so that generation that are nominally baby boomers that migrated here never really had the opportunity to sort of push back on the sort of the entrenchment of Reaganomics that we saw in the 1980s or 90s. And so many of them, civically without the right to vote, were sort of in a position where they might not have agreed with the direction that the country was heading in, but they had to internalize a lot of those values and internalize a lot of the values that seemed to rise to the fore in the 1980s, to the point where I've noticed a kind of a cognitive dissonance among many sort of immigrant baby boomers or baby boomers who came here maybe in the 70s or 80s, where on the one hand, they can't stand Trump. They can't stand to see him on the television. But a lot of the same lessons about how we were supposed to make it as millennials were very much in that kind of mold, right? If you're struggling, it's something that you personally need to work harder. Maybe getting a bad grade is a sign of personal weakness as opposed to a school that maybe needs more funding. And all that to say nothing of the conversation about mental health awareness that I think was exacerbated and intensified in the home in relationships between millennials and baby boomers. But I do think there's sort of a coming back together and an unstated maybe sense that I've sort of noticed in my dad, who supported Bernie when he ran in 2016, that maybe sort of the governing logic of how things worked out for the previous 30 years was trash on one level or another, and we need to take that out and go in a different direction. So,
was your dad an ex-Republican who went Bernie Sanders?
No. I don't want to come on NPR and slander my parents. You know, no. I think if my dad had the chance, he would have voted against Reagan early and often. He couldn't stand Bill Clinton even when he was in there. And so I think I came out on the. I got lucky. I think, yeah. I got lucky.
That's millennial Sean Scott. You're millennials. What year are we using these days?
It's a good question. It shifts a lot. I mean, the functional definition that I use in my book, and the subtitle of the book is A Cultural History of the U.S. from 1982 to the Present. And I use 1982 because the social theorist that came up with the term. Neil Howe and William Strauss, that's the date, that's the cutoff point that they use. Mm. If you ask Pew Research Center, I think they say it's 1981 to 1997. Others have used, have argued for sort of like a liminal generation between Generation X and Millennials, cleverly titled Xennials, between 1977 and 1983. I decide on 1982, but I think it becomes pretty clear through the course of my book that we're really talking about large-scale shifts, and you can draw the boundary a year here or a year there, but it really is not going to make too big of a difference as far as what somebody born in that general era may have experienced.
Sean Scott qualifies to write the new book, Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. Right. Good to see you again, Sean. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Hamilton in Seattle. We're going to come right back with that in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW, Seattle. Seattle, where it has been for nearly 3 weeks now.
Monsieur Hamilton.
Monsieur Lafayette.
In command where you belong.
Are you saying no sweat? We're finally on the field. We've had quite a run.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
So what happens if we win?
I go back to France. I bring freedom to my people if I'm given the chance.
We'll be with you when you do.
Go lead your men.
I'll see you on the other side.
Here we meet again.
I am not throwing away my shot. I
The Broadway musical Hamilton is at Seattle's Paramount Theater for about 3 weeks more. Tickets are selling for $175 to more than $600 a piece, and it's not even the original Broadway cast. What's the big deal about Hamilton in Seattle? Well, here are two people who've seen it. KUOW's arts and culture reporter, Marcy Silman. Hi, Marcy.
Hey, Bill.
And Philip Chavita is the executive director of Intamon Theater in Seattle. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you so much for having me. I love Hamilton. I've had it all day.
We're dancing.
I did know The Immigrants We Get the Job Done. I knew that, even though I'm one of the three who has not seen the musical. Marcy, you were a Hamilton skeptic going in, right?
A little bit. I heard it was great. I liked the music. I'd seen the PBS documentary, and my son is mad for the soundtrack. But I thought, you know, could anything be this godly and wonderful?
Yes.
Could it really be? And it was great. And so I got in my seat and I kind of waited, and it took, you know, probably all of 15 minutes before I was just on the ride.
So help me understand that, because I've had the same, I could find the $500 or whatever it is for a ticket, I suppose, but I've had been of that school of, is it really transcendent, or am I going to go and after all the hype, I'm going to think, oh, it was a really good musical. So what is it that lifted off for you beyond just, that was really good?
Boy, oh boy, there are so many levels to this show of what makes it great. First of all, it's a cast that you haven't seen on a Broadway stage. It's people of all colors and shapes and sizes playing all different roles. For example, the Lafayette in Seattle, at least, was a very tall African-American actor who you don't think of Monsieur Lafayette as. And so that was awesome. It's constant motion and movement from the music to the actual dancing. And you know I'm a dance fan, so I love that, to American history. And at some point you sit back and you say, what? I'm watching a story about this guy who started the Treasury and national debt, and it just doesn't matter. You're just on a ride that is like no other.
I kind of, believe it or not, I had sort of forgotten about the dancing, because I've got my niece and nephew are so into it. I just hear the songs,
right.
I hear the music of it, so I can't visualize it. Philip, you saw Hamilton on Broadway. Original cast, right?
I did.
And what was your experience of it?
Well, I lived in Manhattan at that point, and this is 2015, and I had known about it at the Public Theater, where it had some of its early life, and then it moved to Broadway, and I knew that I needed to get a ticket as soon as I could. So as soon as the tickets went on sale for Broadway, I purchased one, and it was only $125 to sit fifth row orchestra at the Richard Rogers Theater when I purchased a ticket. So that sometimes makes people a little jealous now that I hear about how much it's gone. I had to see the show. I am a person of color, and how much color is there going to be on stage? I was told from my producer friends, this has got a lot of hype. And what I liked is that it has traditional musical values. You hear the chords and the music, and you understand where the music is taking you. It's a story you know or you want to know about our founding fathers. And then it moves you with this rap music, with these delicious lyrics that Lin-Manuel gives you. So it had all the ingredients of what I want to see on stage. And so I rushed to it. And whether it was going to be good or bad, I had to see it. And then it blew my expectations away.
So, Philip, when you say, I'm a person of color, I can guess at what that might mean to you to see Hamilton, but I'd like you to tell me why. Help me understand why that was so important.
Sure. I'm Mexican-American, second generation, and I'm the first in my family to move the arts forward as a career. And so I've seen how entertainment has been in the decades I've been on this earth, and particularly with theater. And we see a lot of white folks producing shows and hiring white authors who write about white stories. And so I grew up with Oklahoma as a great musical to listen to. But then this was in high school, and I was cast as the peddler because that was the one person of color role in the position in the show. So fast forward to Hamilton, where it's a non-white space, where whiteness has been lifted, and you have folks of color represented in so many different ways, and the various differences of colors on stage, it excited me. And it's something that's not put forward often enough. And so when I get to the opportunity to see that, I'm going to put money towards it because I know that money speaks and money's going to keep that going. And I'm hoping that I keep money, putting money into this and other producers are going to pick that up.
It's also exciting. I was sitting next to a young mixed race girl and she was maybe 12 or 13. She was there with her dad and she clearly knew the whole music. She was clutching her T-shirt that she'd bought at the gift stand that's in the lobby and leaning forward. And boy, if she could have elevated herself onto that stage, she would have, because she, it was clear she saw herself on the stage and there was so much excitement and joy. You know, you hear that phrase, lean in. This was truly somebody leaning in physically. And half the time I was watching her because it was so thrilling.
And when you see yourself on stage and you see that representation, you are uplifted as a human being because somebody else has checkmarked that you're worthy of having your story on stage. So I think that's the bigger draw for myself to go there because I just received that checkmark that I'm worthy. And I think that's so important for representation on stage in the entertainment industry, period.
This reminds me of Black Panther, the movie. You know, Hollywood executives have been skeptical that a movie with a primarily black cast would sell internationally, where Hollywood makes so much of its money. Has that skepticism been the same in the theater?
Well, I think there's skepticism that is art going to sell, period. And it's totally subjective. Marcy and I might be sitting and watching the same show and we will have completely different thoughts. So at the end of the day, a producer never knows if they're going to sell their show and they never know if it's going to go well. I can't imagine that Lin-Manuel, when he wrote it, he may have thought it was going to be great, but he never knew that it was going to grow to this success. So that's always the beginning case. Is this going to make money? I think that when a story resonates with you, you have... you think it's going to sell a little bit better. So I've seen in cases when you have some white producers producing a show and the show may not resonate directly with them, they'll have reservations of whether or not that's going to sell because in their mind, they understand what sells to the public. Mm. So I think that it's more of a case of let's get leaders of color up there producing more work so that this is not a question of whether or not this is going to sell. It's a question of whether or not this is good art.
And the thing about Hamilton, though, has transcended that this is a show with a creator of color and a cast of color because it does what the best art does, which is resonate. It shows us our humanity, our shared humanity. And so it has resonated, clearly resonated with, I don't know what the audience figures are overall, but lots and lots and lots of tickets. And so it does something else. It doesn't just show that this kind of story is going to sell. It also shows that live performance is and the shared experience of watching something together in the dark, experiencing it together also sells that live theater is alive and vibrant and brings us something.
So you don't think it matters much that the cast is portraying historical figures who were white? They don't think the commercial success needs that crossover appeal?
I didn't actually think about it because let me say that the only thing I really thought about Alexander Hamilton, I was once given a book about his daughter when I was a kid, and he's on, I think, a $10 bill, maybe, right? $10 bill?
I believe that's right.
That's all I knew until this musical. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's all I knew. I didn't know he was an immigrant and the son of a perhaps unmarried woman, and that he was a genius and that he did all these things. So it might make me want to learn more about American history, but I think that's besides the point. It was a story about people and their hopes and their fears and how they looked. It showed me people that were as people and not as colors.
This is Marcy Silman, KUOW's arts and culture reporter, and Philip Chavira is the executive director of Intimon Theater in Seattle. And Philip, you mentioned you paid, what, $150 or something?
$125.
$125 in New York City to see the original Broadway cast in the orchestra section. Now those seats obviously sell for hundreds or $1,000 or whatever. So is that a bad thing?
So I was at a New York Times talk. Lin-Manuel was on stage and Danai Gurira, who wrote a play that I produced on Broadway called Eclipse. She was also part of the panel. And somebody asked Lin, well, how do you feel about that your tickets are so expensive and it's becoming almost unattainable. And he smiled and he shrugged a little and he said, I'm happy. And I don't know many artists who attain this level of stardom and also an ever-giving paycheck. So I'm happy that he has that. And I'm also happy that he's embracing the fact that he did make something strong and it has been commercialized and he is making money. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important that art gives back. I know that Hamilton on Broadway provides a lot of tickets to inner city schools to attend the shows. They give back to the community. They also do a lottery system to get on. So I think it's important once a show reaches a certain level that the producers take care for the community, that the producers make sure that there is an affordable ticket somewhere, that people who need to see the show happen. I know that at Intimon, we make sure that we have affordable tickets for folks to come see our shows. For instance, our show here at Arts West that is opening this Wednesday and running through March 25th, we have tickets online in the tens of dollars, and then we have tickets to walk up because we want this to be attainable to most folks.
Marcy, have you seen a Hamilton effect of any kind in Seattle theater, whether it's the kind of art that people are interested in producing or a racial effect or there's a new audience to theater that's never seen theater before? Any Hamilton effect in Seattle?
A Hamilton effect. I think it predated Hamilton coming to Seattle, actually. I mean, Intimon that Philip runs is a case in point. It's a very much dedicated to social justice and equity. But I think that what we're seeing is an acknowledgement that theater is not just by white men. I mean, women really haven't had access to stages in terms of producing content, presenting the content.
I agree.
Writing
women
the
a minority in the arts.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
And so I think what we're seeing, at least, you know, superficially, is instead of having, you know, the Black playwright in February for Black History Month and a woman in March for Women's History Month and a Asian writer for whatever month is the API celebration month, Asian Pacific Islander month, that people are really looking at seasons and taking affirmative steps to have at least thinking about equity in what they present and who presents it and who we see on the stage and who we don't see behind the scenes, producing like Philip is or building the sets or running the soundboard. I think it's on the forefront of people's minds in theater, in dance, and in music in Seattle.
So Philip, in case a Hamilton fan wants to see more theater in Seattle, what is one thing you recommend?
Well, definitely come to Intimon.
What show is, what's the current show?
Here by Taylor Mack, that's at Arts West.
H-I-R.
H-I-R, pronounced here. It's a play on him and her. Other good art to see in Seattle. Well, I think there's so much good art. You can head to SAM, Seattle Art Museum, and see Crazy Things. And talking about something that really blew up, I think, when Kusama came here and the Infinite Mirrors, I think that was, that hit next level. That hit stardom, and it had a national presence before getting here.
Everyday Black at the Northwest African American Museum.
Really shout out to David Rue.
Yeah.
What's Everyday Black about?
Everyday Black is a collection of portraits of everyday Black Seattleites by Zorn B. Taylor and Jessica Reichel, who I actually profiled, so you can find her on our website today. There's beautiful paintings coming up in April at On the Boards, Black Boys, Danny Terrell's piece. It's kind of theater dance-ish and more. So there's just a lot of people making great art in the city.
I also really like Two Trains Running, August Wilson, that just played at the Rep.
Right.
Amazing performances. I think it's such a beautiful show. It had so much diversity on stage, and it was supported financially really well from the Rep, and I appreciated that.
Philip Chavira is the executive director of Intimon Theater in Seattle, and their current production at Arts West is Here by Taylor Mack.
Yes.
H-I-R. And Marcy Silman is KUOW's arts and culture reporter. They've seen Hamilton. I haven't, but now I'm thinking, boy, my 11-year-old would appreciate it, right?
You need to be in the room where it happens.
Now, see, I know that reference. But do we have to do some homework before we go?
So no.
Really?
No. I knew less than anybody about it. And I said to my son, who told me to listen to the soundtrack, you know what? When people showed up, when you showed up, Philip, the first time, you didn't know anything.
I knew a little. The soundtrack had been out on Spotify, so I was able to listen to it a little bit. But there was no way I could consume the whole thing, digest and understand all the characters and the storylines. No. So I went in pretty fresh.
Philip and Marcy, thanks for coming in fresh to KUOW's The Record today. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Hamilton will be playing at the Paramount Theater until March 18th. And if you're lucky, maybe you can score a $10 ticket through the Hamilton Lottery. That's the show for today. The show produced today by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening. Let's do it again tomorrow.